This election has taken a worrying twist.
The campaign heats up.
Well, I think it was a coup.
Some of their stuff to just be plain weird.
She's more liberal than Bernie Sanders.
Every move, every breaking event.
I trust the sky to get it right.
This is News Talk 97.3, The Sky.
Happy Friday. We made it. It is 9:36. You're tuned to the Bob Rose Show. Greg Cassidy is here as well. And right now we've got a special guest who is joining us, Chris Martz. He's a meteorologist who, well, he goes against the grain. And good morning, Chris. How you doing?
Doing good. Thanks for having me on.
Hey, it's our pleasure. I think Greg found you on Facebook, and he was interested, and he was telling me about it, and said, hey, let's get this guy on the air and talk to him, because I think we're like-minded, but we don't have the same background. You do. Tell us a little bit about your meteorologist background.
Yeah, so I'm actually a meteorology student at Millersville University near Lancaster, Pennsylvania. I'm a rising senior, so I'll actually have my degree. Once I get into the spring next year in May, I'll graduate, have my bachelor's of science degree. But yeah, so I'm a meteorology student, and that's my background. I got a minor in emergency management as well.
Are they pretty open minded at the university? Because you go against the grain a little bit, and is that going to impact your ability to get your degree?
No, because I'm paying the university money to go to school, so they just want my money. They don't really care all that much. There's not really a whole lot of pushback from within the university. I mean, my professors don't necessarily share my views on everything, but they have my back because a lot of them are old school, and they have my back with my right to free speech on my Twitter or Facebook page, and they understand that I'm smart, and I back my post up with data and evidence. So they have nothing that they can really say. They can't say that I don't justify my position on it. I do it in good faith. So they've had my back. There's been people that have been trying to pressure the university into kicking me out of the program, the professors to kick me out of the program, but from outside. There's been a lot of that, but they just ignore it because I have a good relationship with my professors. So that's really nice.
Well, you were probably just a little kid when this whole climate change idea kind of came about, and they started to try to instill fear in people. And I was wondering back then what this was really all about. Now through the years, well, first of all, we're not underwater. We live in Florida. We're low anyway, elevation wise. So yeah, when time passes and all the prognostications were wrong, then you have to say, so what are they really trying to do? Why do you think there is such a push for people to accept climate change?
I think this goes back to the 1980s. The United Nations Environment Program had this kind of anti-capitalist, anti-oil company agenda, and they needed some sort of way that they could get policy to try and control the energy industries and I guess rein them in a little bit. And they needed something to regulate carbon dioxide emissions. They had this kind of agenda. They wanted to put the policy cart before the scientific horse. So to speak, something that Dr. Judith Curry, she's a climatologist, she talked about this in her John Stossel interview back in October. And the IPCC, the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, was created in the 1980s, 1990s, and they used the scientific community. They assembled these panel of scientists to create these reports that basically were to look specifically for evidence of human-induced climate change and make sure the impacts were supposed to be, and put in the reports that the impacts are going to be dangerous and catastrophic. They were not tasked with looking for evidence of natural climate change or benefits of global warming, just specifically evidence that it was human-caused and that the impacts are dangerous. And so we've put out all these reports since 1990 that with each new report, the evidence, I guess, from their standpoint, becomes clearer and clearer. And so they want to use the scientific community as a crutch to pass along kind of these policies that are that regulate energy companies, put a tax on carbon. A lot of this with an anti-capitalist motive behind it. They use the scientific community to build a case to regulate carbon dioxide emissions, regulate oil companies. And this entire organization, that in the United Nations and academia, universities across the world, and government agencies, like NOAA and NASA and the Met Office, they all employ, you know, these places employ hundreds of thousands of people whose livelihoods depend on there being a quote-unquote climate crisis. You know, not necessarily that there's a crisis, but at least giving the public the perception that there is one. And so if you have, as long as there's a reason to keep people alarmed, you get this money that's shuffling through the research grants to keep these people bankrolled. And so it's very hard if you're a scientist in academia, you know, if you're a professor at a university or you're a government research scientist, it's very hard to secure funding if you go against the narrative because it's not lucrative. It doesn't, it goes against the grain. And that's kind of how it is. So when the funding agencies send out these opportunities, these announcements of opportunities for research grants, when you apply for it, these opportunities, they have very strict guidelines. So if you say they wanted to investigate the impacts of human-caused climate change on wildfire activity in the western United States, if you apply for it and you outline in your proposal how the methods you're going to use to go about this proposal, about this research, when you apply for the grant, if you say that, well, I don't think climate change is really impacting wildfire activity all that much, but I want to look at how, say, poor forest management is affecting it, then you're probably not going to get funded. But if you're to the guidelines laid out in the grant, you'll secure your funding. And you probably get your paper published in a prestigious journal, and your work will be perceived as important. You'll get accolades from these scientific organizations like the American Geophysical Union, and you'll get press coverage, all that. It's about fame and notoriety and a lucrative career if you go with the grain rather than against it.
Wow. And, you know, that you've answered a lot of questions, the UN being at the heart of a lot of this. My daughter did like some research and stuff, and she always believed in sort of the purity of it. And I tried to explain. I said, well, you got to follow the money. Who's paying for the study is an important part of it. And you just outlined it. To get the grant itself, you've got to basically, you know, you've already weighted it. You've already told them what the outcome is. Now you're going to back it up with the research instead of collecting data and let the science be the outcome.
Correct. It's an exercise in circular reasoning. Now, I don't doubt that humans contribute to global warming in some capacity, and most scientists, even on the skeptical side of things, agree with me that, I mean, it's not controversial to say, and the physics are very clear. I was talking to physicist Dr. William Happer, a world-renowned physicist at Princeton the other day, and he was a science advisor to three presidents, so I had a great opportunity to talk to him. We went over the actual physics of this back a couple Mondays ago. If you double the carbon dioxide level in Earth's atmosphere from any concentration, whether it's 400 parts per million to 800 or 800 to 1600, whatever, it just takes longer and longer to double it. So it's kind of a logarithmic effect. But anyway, anytime you double the atmospheric carbon dioxide concentration, what happens is it reduces the rate at which Earth cools. The radiation goes out by 3 watts per meter squared. That increases enhances Earth's natural greenhouse effect, which is largely due to water vapor. It keeps the Earth warmer than it otherwise would be without the presence of water vapor and clouds and stuff like that. It only enhances it by about 1%. And the direct warming effect from this is for per doubling of CO2. Is only about 0.72 degrees Celsius, 7/10 of a degree Celsius. Now, the Earth has warmed, we have not doubled carbon dioxide concentrations since the pre-industrial era. We're about 50% of the way there. But the Earth has, it's estimated to have warmed about 1.2 degrees Celsius.
Now, go ahead.
But that is largely probably due to urban heat island effects. And, reduced cloud cover. which we don't really know what the cause of that is. There's debate in literature about that.
This really, I think you've given a lot of people kind of a renewed interest in all this, following the money, how the science can be explained. So this doubling of the CO2, which could have a serious effect long term, but when we say long term, we're talking thousands of years, right?
I mean, hundreds of thousands of years. But any either way, I mean, the direct warming effect is very, very small. I mean, when you look at things like changes in cloud cover, which have to do with ocean cycles, and sulfur dioxide concentrations from shipping fuel, which is a man-made impact. And you also look at urbanization. Cities are warmer than the rural surroundings, and that's where most of our thermometer data comes from, is the cities. Those are orders of magnitude much more powerful than CO2. And then you have volcanoes that, when they erupt, they have impacts. They're kind of a wild card. You have changes in solar activity. I don't think changes in solar activity right now have had much to do with what's going on, but I think a lot of it's tied to our oceans. They have 1,000 times the heat capacity of the atmosphere, and there's not been a lot of research on how that kind of modulates the climate system.
Well, I figured it did. Now, I guess the final question is, so this is the hottest day on record. This is the hottest summer. We keep hearing this kind of thing over and over again. Does the data back that up?
Well, in the United States, there's actually been very little warming since 1895. If you look at the actual measured thermometer data, the 1930s were the warmest decade. 1921, the 2012 was the warmest year on record, but 1921 was the second. And only two of the top 10 warmest years have been in the last, 30 years, if you look at the actual raw temperature data. Now, the claim that we just had the hottest day on the record globally, which we've heard about that all summer long, it was a big headline. They had the temperature, the global average temperature, they computed it down to the nearest hundredth of a degree. That's two decimal places. That's ridiculous. You cannot have that kind of precision. Even if you had a spatially evenly distributed thermometer network, it's just impossible. They get this data from what's called the ERA5 reanalysis data from the Copernicus ECMWF. And this reanalysis data integrates some past observations, and they fill in the gaps with models, and then they run it like a weather forecast model.
Yeah, fill in the gap with
useful,
models.
It's useful, but it's not measurement. It's not an actual measurement. It's an estimation, and they're claiming they can get this down to the nearest hundredth of a degree Celsius. It only goes back to 1940 on a planet that's 4.5 billion years old.
Chris Martz.
No, it's not the hottest day.
Chris, love it. Love what you bring to the table. Keep up the good work. And you can find Chris Martz, M-A-R-T-Z, on Facebook and X and everywhere else. We've got to run. Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for having me, Bob. Thanks for having me, Greg. Appreciate it.
All right.
See y'all later.